2 years. Now she showed knowledge of traveling that even he didn't have. Even if she spent all her time in Enosh asking questions, why was she so eager to learn? How had she learned so much so quickly? She spoke as if the things she knew were common sense. "What do you think?" he sent to his doll. Only when he received no response did he realize that he had forgotten to take a doll from his room in Valenhall. He had dropped Lilia off when he stopped by the bedroom for his cloak, sure that the Nye would have washed and returned it. But the cloak was nowhere to be found, and he had to backtrack to the bathroom, where his cloak and Azura still lay where he left them. After that, he had been in too much of a hurry to think of swinging back to his room for another doll. Then again, what was wrong with the Nye? They had never shirked their duties before. The eldest was probably angry with him for some unknowable reason, and wouldn't allow the others to serve him until Simon made up for whatever it was he had done. That was probably it. Simon realized he had gone too long without speaking. "Oh, sorry, he fought me. We had a fight in the forest, but he said I was terrible." Lia twisted her bracelet around her wrist, lost in thought. "Combat ability," she said. "I suppose that makes sense." Something Kai said floated back to Simon. "I don't think he let me in because of the fight," Simon said. "He said he could teach anyone. I think he was trying to make sure I wanted it bad enough." "No," Lia said thoughtfully. "You have to be compatible. He must have known you were somehow." She sounded certain, but the more Simon thought about it, the more sure he became that he was right. "I don't think that's how Valenhall works," he said. "You don't get anything in Valenhall because you're suitable or because you need it. You have to earn it. If you're skilled enough and determined enough to pass the tests in the house, then I guess you're qualified. I think anyone can try if they want." Lia stared at him for a long time, chewing on her lip. "No compatibility test. I suppose that would make sense," she said at last. "They say... well, never mind. But that would make sense." Simon's pocket began to vibrate. Lia glanced at his buzzing pants, back up to Simon's face, and then back at his pants again. "Would you like me to leave?" she asked politely. Simon's face heated, but he pulled out the shaking acorn in its golden cage. "Helen needs me," he said. "Do you know where he is?" Lia's gaze sharpened. She took him by the arm again and began to guide him down the hall. "I believe he's finishing up his speech. I'll take you there. Did he say why he needed you?" Simon held up the caged acorn, which was hurling itself against the bars with animal ferocity. "You know as much as I do," he said. "They say the Grandmasters are meeting today," she added as they walked. "That could be it," Simon responded. She pressed up against his arm as she guided him down a hallway, and he was torn between moving a proper distance away and pretending not to notice so that she would stay that way as long as possible. Better not to react, he told himself, and stayed where he was. He got the impression that Kayla would have laughed herself sick. "When you find out, let me know," she said. "I need to know whether or not I should be worried." She smiled at him, which at close range had a devastating effect. He caught himself wondering if she would be impressed by the powers of a traveler. Without thinking, he spoke. "You've been different lately." Her face didn't change, but he recognized that it had become a mask to hide her real expression. "It's not like we've spent much time together, Simon." She pulled away from his arm almost casually. "Well, he had started this. You might as well go all the way." "No, I didn't mean that. You seem more confident since we left the village, not less. I have no idea what I'm doing, and Alan's only pretending. But you almost seem more comfortable outside the village than you were when we lived there." Lia kept her gaze focused on the end of the hall. "I lived most of my life outside of Myria, you know." "That could be it," Simon said. "You seem like a different person now, that's all. Like you were one Lia back in the village, and now you're another Lia outside." "Maybe outside Lia is better," she suggested with half a smile. "Maybe. I just wish I knew which of you was real." Lia lost her smile. They walked the rest of the way in silence, Simon mentally kicking himself the entire way. He should have kept his mouth shut. Simon eventually made his way to the huge square outside the Grandmaster's palace. The space was crammed with thousands of people, more people than he had ever seen at any one time. Maybe more people than he had ever seen total. They packed the flagstones, stood on nearby stoops, or leaned out the windows of other buildings. A handful of people even stood on the rooftops around the square, listening. From a balcony high up on the palace, Alan spoke. His voice had been amplified so that everyone in the square could hear him, which Simon assumed was some sort of traveler thing. After listening to Alan speak for a minute or two, Simon had to admit, he was good at this. The setting sun caught his golden hair and armor, making him shine like a burning star, and he spoke with the intensity of a natural storyteller.
"I saw friends snatched from me on Damascan ropes," Alan was saying. "I saw family cut down by Damascan spears. Their faces, as they begged for mercy, plague me today. They will continue to haunt me for the rest of my life."
He paused for a moment, as if to collect himself, and together the crowd held one breath.
"Overlord Malachi was..."
There was enough cheering at the word was that Alan had to stop.
"He was a traveler of Naraka. As many of you know, Naraka, the Cavern of Flame, represents law and order. Any traveler of Naraka should be driven, almost compelled, to uphold the law and the highest moral principles. When a true Naraka traveler sees a man cheated by his neighbor, he does not hesitate. He makes sure that justice is done. When I stood in Malachi's hall, when I looked the Overlord in the eye, I told him why I had come. I told him I came for justice."
The crowd reacted as though he had promised each of them a bucket of gold. They screamed in a roaring ocean tide of noise that made Simon wince and cover one ear. He wished he had worn his cloak so that he could stuff its fabric into his ears, but he carried it slung over one shoulder. Wearing a hooded black cloak in this crowd would do nothing but make him stand out, and not in any way he would have enjoyed. Besides, it was hot. The cheers went on for a full minute before Alan waved the crowd to silence. He began to speak, but Simon was distracted by a glint of gold to the corner of his eye. When he turned to look, he stared straight into the beak of a golden hummingbird, hovering inches from his nose. Simon let out a yelp and stumbled backwards, out of the crowd. A few people looked curiously at the gold bird, but apparently such sights were nothing to be concerned about in Enosh, because they quickly turned back to Alan. The bird followed Simon as he backed out of the crowd. Simon eyed it warily as he searched for a place far enough where he could examine the bird in relative peace. It obviously wasn't going to attack him, or it would have done so already. Besides, he had faced worse than a shimmering golden hummingbird. But he suspected he knew where the bird had come from, and if he was right, it would have a message for him. He finally found a place, a thin alley in a shadow between two buildings, that wasn't packed with people. Simon turned to face the bird, which had followed at an uncomfortably close distance of about 2 inches from his head. "Well?" Simon asked. The tiny bird spoke in a rich, rumbling baritone that sounded like it came from a burly lumberjack.
"I have a message for you, traveler of Valenhall."
Startled, Simon almost backed into the wall of the alley. "Is that your real voice?" The hummingbird tilted its head to the side, in a motion that reminded Simon vividly of Kai.
"It is. Why do you ask me this?"
Nothing," Simon said quickly. "Never mind. Did Alan send you?"
"I was sent by Alan, son of Torin, the Elysian traveler," the hummingbird responded. "He wished me to bring you a message. The Grandmasters don't trust you. Naraka desires you to be kept away from Alan, and many of the others agree that you are not to be trusted. He has invited you to their war council, but he has done so against their wishes. He believes that they may try to exclude you, or to trick you somehow. He wished you to be forewarned."
Alan, acting kind and thoughtful. To me. Simon suddenly felt guilty for thinking that Alan looked like a pompous painted fool up there in his gold armor.
"That is very kind of him," Simon said.
"Will there be danger?"
The bird hesitated before responding, in his bass rumble. "Alan does not believe so, traveler. This is the end of the message. Farewell."
The golden bird flitted off, but hesitated a few feet away, hovering in place. Seconds later, he darted back over. His beak flew at Simon's face like an arrow, and it was all he could do to stop himself from instinctively backing up a step, but the hummingbird drew himself to a halt at the same uncomfortably close distance to Simon's face.
"I feel compelled to add something, Valenhall Traveler. Alan, son of Torin, does not believe you are in physical danger. He believes that you are, at most, at risk of being excluded or embarrassed."
The messenger hovered even closer, leading Simon to wonder if he was in danger of having his eye spitted on the end of the bird's sharp beak.
"I remember the Grandmasters of old, and I do not agree with Alan's assessment. I believe you should be on your guard."
"Thank you," Simon said to the bird. In his own ears, his voice sounded dark. He felt as though he was back in Valenhall, surrounded by traps and enemies, and the certainty that, as soon as he put a foot wrong, he would die. In some strange way, the thought made him feel a bit better. He had conquered Valenhall, at least to a point. He would conquer this. The hummingbird bobbed once in midair, then zipped off toward the Grandmaster's palace. Simon took a deep breath, forcing his mind back into the familiar patterns of the house. He had to be ready to fight on an instant's notice. As more cheers erupted from the nearby square, shaking the ground and signaling the end of Alan's speech, Simon pulled on his black cloak. The War Council of the Enosh Grandmasters took place in a room specially designed for the purpose. The centerpiece of the room was a polished stone table that took up the vast majority of the floor. 9 banners hung on the walls, each marked with what Simon assumed were the symbols of the territories that the Grandmasters traveled. A clawed fist clutched a ball of flame on a red banner above Grandmaster Naraka. She hunched in her chair and pointed her red lenses at Alan, ignoring Simon entirely. A fan of 4 feathers marked a brown and white banner above Grandmaster Avernus, a severe-looking woman with straight silver hair who had a habit of looking down her nose at everyone else. The dark, thin man sitting beneath a green banner commanded much of Simon's attention. He had barely said a word, but he had a manner about him that looked like one of the Dragon Army. Dangerous grace barely restrained. From the symbol on the banner above him, a snake eating its own tail around a thunderstorm, Simon guessed that he was Grandmaster Endros. There were others that Simon had never met and could not guess, like the person wrapped all in silver and gray ribbons. He couldn't see an inch of skin. Even that Grandmaster's voice was altered so that they spoke in a toneless buzz, and Simon couldn't figure out if it was a man or a woman. Their banner was no help, 2 crescent moons bracketing a full moon with a starburst in its center. Simon couldn't help but notice that there were only 9 territories represented, when there should have been 10, not counting Valenhall, which Enosh barely seemed to acknowledge as a real territory. There should have been 9 original territories and Elysia. He supposed they couldn't represent Ragnaros, the 9th territory, because its only travelers were Damascan, but he still found its absence odd. Alan sat at the head of the table, underneath a gold banner marked with the same symbol on the breastplate of his armor, a winged sword, point down, set against a rising sun. By contrast, they put Simon in a rickety wooden chair at the corner of the room. It creaked when he moved. The Grandmasters and Alan had spent the first few minutes of the meeting reviewing Alan's speech and the general tone of the populace. It seemed they were all very pleased with themselves, and Simon was becoming bored enough that he wondered if he could open a gate right there and leave. He wasn't even sure that would get their attention. Only the hummingbird's warning kept his attention focused. He might be in danger, so he needed all his wits about him. Besides, if they wanted him to leave, that was more than enough reason to stay where he was. After a round of verbal backpatting, in which all the Grandmasters agreed that the day had been a rousing success, Grandmaster Naraka slapped her palm down on the table in front of her. At the sound, everyone else turned to her. No one seemed particularly surprised that she had cut them off, rather than waiting for her turn to speak.
"That's enough of that," Naraka croaked. "Eliadel, we have news of great import. We have waited to share this with you only so that we could verify it ourselves."
Grandmaster Helgard, a bearded bear of a man, grinned and sat forward in his chair. He looked almost childishly eager. The Grandmaster of some territory Simon didn't know, its symbol was a mountain and 2 crossed hammers, shifted uncomfortably in her seat. She was old enough to be Simon's mother, with touches of gray here and there in her hair, but she looked like a villager, dark skin, dark hair, and simple brown clothes. The one decoration she wore was a looped double necklace of some blue-green stone. That Grandmaster shook her head. "We are not ready," she began, but Grandmaster Naraka cut her off.
"Not yet, Grandmaster Ornheim," Naraka said harshly. "There are those in this room who are not qualified to hear the following discussion."
"So the territory with all the rocks is called Ornheim," Simon thought. "Got it." Only a few weeks ago, he had suffered quite a collection of injuries at the hands of living stone summoned by Ornheim travelers. Then he realized that all the Grandmasters had turned to look at him. His senses sharpened, and he reached his mind out to Valenhall. At even the slightest hint that they were trying to summon something, he would call steel and essence and be out the door before they could blink. Alan spoke up, speaking with the same resonant command he had used when delivering his speech.
"Grandmaster Naraka, Simon is here at my invitation. Whatever you have to say to me, you can say to him."
Mentally, Simon took back every petty and insulting thing he had ever said about Alan. Grandmaster Endros turned his dark eyes on Simon.
"Your pardon, Eliadel, but I have crossed travelers of Valenhall in the past. They call themselves the Dragon Army, and as far as I can tell, their only purpose is to murder other travelers."
Several other Grandmasters muttered agreement. One of Endros's hands drifted down to his sword belt, which had been draped over the back of his chair. From the belt hung a pair of identical scabbarded swords.
"With the Council's permission," Grandmaster Endros continued, "I would welcome the opportunity to eject the Valenhall Traveler personally."
Simon decided that, if it came to a fight, he would take out Grandmaster Endros first.
"Seconded," came a lilting voice from a pudgy woman underneath a flower banner.
"Three voices agree," said Grandmaster Avernus. "Let it be done."
Endros began to stand, and Simon called steel. The icy power rushed through his blood. If the Grandmaster was anything like Cormac, he would need to summon his thunderstorm first. At that point, Simon would call Essence and Azura. He had nothing to defend against a bolt of lightning. His only hope would be to take the Grandmaster out before he could gather himself for a real attack. With a surprisingly loud crack, Alan slammed his gauntleted fist down on the table.
"Grandmaster Endros," Alan said, "I believe I made myself clear. Simon stays where he is. Now, either sit down or remove yourself from this council."
His voice carried a weight that Simon would never have believed came from a 17-year-old. Endros moved his eyes from Simon to Alan. He hesitated a moment, looking between Alan and Grandmaster Naraka, before he bowed and sat back down.
"I live to serve, Eliadel," he said.
Alan turned toward Naraka as though nothing had happened, though Simon noticed a minuscule smile twitching at the corners of his mouth.
"Grandmaster Naraka, you have the floor," Alan said.
He sat, and Naraka rose to her feet. Only her head and shoulders rose over the surface of the table. Grandmaster Naraka turned her head to address the council.
"Eliadel, and those few of us who have not received word, there has been a major development in the last 24 hours. At long last, one of the incarnations has escaped its prison."
Two or three Grandmasters gasped, but most nodded along. Simon had only heard incarnations mentioned once or twice, in an attitude of dread. He had an image of an incarnation as a terrible monster that rose from the depths of a territory to spread madness and chaos. So he was not prepared to see Grandmaster Naraka break into a wide smile. It did horrible things to her wrinkled face.
"Brothers and sisters," she said, "the prophecy of the rising sun has already borne fruit. The reign of the Crimson Vault has almost come to an end."
Each man or woman, or indistinct androgynous figure in the case of the silver-wrapped Grandmaster, reacted differently to the announcement. Most of them smiled. Grandmaster Helgard laughed and pounded the table. Grandmaster Ornheim stroked her stone necklace, looking thoughtful. One Grandmaster, a young athletic man underneath a banner of three silver keys, simply nodded.
He had the expression of a man with a job to do, and he would do his best whether he enjoyed it or not. After a few moments, they calmed down, and Grandmaster Naraka spoke again. Her customary twisted, sour expression was back in place.
"This gives us an opportunity. As you are all aware, since Overlord Malachi's death this past month, Damasca has begun to prepare for war."
Simon struggled to control his expression. It looked like he was the only one in the room not aware of the impending conflict. Grandmaster Naraka continued.
"Our information suggests that King Zachareth plans to first scour our territory outposts, and then, when all our escape routes are blocked, he will come against our city in full force. This means that the attack on the former Grandmaster Helgard, saints preserve him, was not an isolated incident."
All the other Grandmasters, except Helgard, murmured, "Saints preserve," in unison. The current Grandmaster Helgard scowled through his beard, and Simon could have sworn he heard the man growl. No one had told Simon about a Damascan attack. If the previous Grandmaster Helgard had been killed, then staying in Enosh might be even more dangerous than going home. Maybe he and Leah should round up the other villagers and head back to Myria, leaving the travelers to tear each other apart on their own. An image flashed in Simon's mind, his mother's corpse, twisted and broken on the floor of a cave. That was what happened when the villagers tried to stay out of the way. Myria sat between Enosh and the closest Damascan cities. The villagers would not be spared. They would be crushed underfoot.
"This presents us with an opportunity," Naraka continued. "Grandmaster Lyriel..."
The silver-wrapped figure stood, bowing slightly to Grandmaster Naraka. "Thank you, Grandmaster," it said. His or her voice vibrated, as if it had to travel through a long tunnel, and emerged in a monotonous buzz. "As you know, the overlords are charged with keeping the incarnation sealed in their prisons. Normally, an assault on the overlords is ill-advised, because any approach by land or by traveling is too well protected." At the head of the table, Alan smirked. "That is no longer the case," Grandmaster Lyriel continued. "Many Damascan travelers, and in some cases even the overlords themselves, have been called away to prepare for the war effort. We have identified 3, possibly 4 trees that are poorly defended, but they will not remain that way for long. In my opinion, now is the perfect time for an assault." Grandmasters Helgard and Endros grinned at each other like boys. Beneath a gray banner marked with a purple flower, the pudgy Grandmaster sighed and shook her head, resting her chin in her hand. The Grandmaster beneath the 3 silver keys sat up straight and squared his shoulders like a soldier at attention. Grandmaster Avernus combed a finger through her long silver hair, looking down at each of her peers in turn before she spoke.
"We should see to this matter personally, I think," she said.
Grandmaster Lyriel bowed, silver ribbons rustling, and sat back down. Nearby, Naraka laced her hands together thoughtfully.
"Small teams, I think," she said. "Each led by at least 1 Grandmaster. 3 of us must strike at Damasca in an attempt to destroy the trees, and a 4th team should go to aid the escaped incarnation."
"Aid it?" Alan asked. "Aid it in what? What does it want to do?" Simon had wondered the same thing, but he knew better than to ask. They would only ignore anything he said.
"Destroy Damasca," Grandmaster Helgard declared.
"Why?" Grandmaster Naraka straightened her red spectacles and took on a lecturing tone.
"The incarnations are forces of nature. They are noble creatures with incalculable power, but being in this world too long drives them mad. They are like rabid beasts, and Damasca has kept these beasts whipped, beaten, and chained underground for 3 centuries. It is only natural that the first thing an incarnation would do when freed is to bend all its powers toward Damasca's destruction."
All the other Grandmasters nodded or made sounds of agreement. Alan, on the other hand, looked straight at Simon. His gaze made Simon inexplicably nervous. What is he looking at me for? Simon wondered. Did he want advice? Did he want Simon to say something? Maybe he just wanted to know what Simon thought. Alan raised his eyebrows in a question, and Simon shrugged. Seeming to accept that as an answer, Alan turned back to the Grandmaster and listened to their continued conversation. They were preparing to vote on whether or not to attack Damasca, but Simon had no doubts about which way the debate would fall. Personally, Simon wasn't sure what he thought about this whole business with the Incarnations. He had little love for Damasca, that was true. Though the village where he grew up was technically part of the Damascan kingdom, they almost never saw any full citizen or full-blooded Damascan. The villages all considered themselves separate from the kingdom, and for the most part, the people of Damasca respected that. Simon's only real interaction with Damascans had come at one end or another of a sword. Then again, he was beginning to suspect that the Grandmasters of Enosh weren't much better. "It's none of my business," Simon decided. "I can stay in the house. I'll leave these problems to people who want to take care of them, like Alan. Maybe I can stay out of the way and let this whole mess pass me by." It was probably his imagination, but he could have sworn he heard Dahls laughing all the way from Valenhall. Chapter 7. Avoiding Justice. Simon sat through the rest of the meeting, although it mostly consisted of the various Grandmasters discussing what they should decide at their next meeting, which would be the real War Council. If being a Grandmaster took this much debate and this many meetings, Simon was surprised anyone wanted the job. It would drive him insane. When Grandmaster Naraka declared the meeting adjourned, Simon was the first out of the room. No need to stick around to give the Grandmasters a chance to threaten him. To his surprise, though, a golden gauntlet wrapped around his arm and pulled him up short when he was only a few steps into the hallway. "Simon," Alan said, "speak with me a minute. Let me walk you to your room." His voice was friendly, but the fact that he was still speaking like a lord was enough to put Simon's back up. He almost refused out of sheer reaction, but Alan had stuck up for him at least twice today. When Alan removed his hand from Simon's arm, Simon continued walking in step with him. "You didn't need me there today," Simon said. "Why not?" Alan asked. Simon threw a surprised look at Alan, but Alan was focused on the end of the hallway. "Why not? I didn't do anything. I didn't have anything to say. I sat there and let them insult me." Alan shrugged one shoulder. "They have problems with Valenhall travelers. Don't worry, you'll bring them around." Not for the first time, Simon wondered where Alan got his blind confidence. "I'm not sure I want to bring them around," Simon said. "I'm not sure I want anything from them at all. This isn't my fight." A pair of passing servants, carrying a huge laundry basket between them, saw Alan and bowed deeply. Alan didn't seem to notice. Alan looked as though Simon had announced his plan to burn down a nursery. "You assaulted Malachi's home with me. You've killed more Damascan travelers than anyone. Simon, a traveler from Damascus killed your mother. If this is anyone's fight, it's yours." Grief and anger and guilt boiled inside of Simon, rising up in an unpleasant mess. He hated remembering the travelers and soldiers he'd killed, hated the feeling of resistance as Azura passed through their bodies. Each time, Simon had felt backed into the fight, as though he'd been left with no other options. But the fact remained that he had killed people. He had killed a lot of people. On the other hand, he didn't need Alan reminding him who killed his mother. Alan had been there, facing the traveler that killed Simon's mother. For all his power, he hadn't done anything to save her. Then again, Alan hadn't been the one determined to keep her safe. "You don't need to remind me," Simon said. For a moment, he heard in his own voice an echo of Kai at his most threatening, soft and dangerous. "I remember every second of what happened in that cave, and I regret every drop of blood I've spilled since then. But..." His certainty faded. He wasn't even sure how to phrase what he had sensed over this past month. "Alan, you didn't hear what Malachi said at the end. I don't think he meant for any of this to happen. I think there's more going on here than we know. I want to stay out of it." There. He'd said it. He had no reason to fight in this conflict. His mother was avenged, the other villagers saved. He still wanted to explore Valenhall to become stronger, but that was a separate issue. Or is it separate? Simon wondered. Why do I need to keep traveling if there's no one out there to fight? They walked in silence for another few minutes, eventually reaching the door to Simon's room. A woman with feathers in her hair and wearing a buckskin dress, a traveler of Avernus, raised a hand and called out to Alan in greeting. He politely excused himself. As she walked away, the owl on her shoulder swiveled its head around to stare straight at Simon. "Those birds creep me out," Simon said, mostly because he hadn't said anything in minutes.
"Simon, there is more going on here than we know," Alan said seriously. "That's why I need you here, with me. I think, whatever happens, that you and I are going to be important."
In his gleaming gold armor, with his golden hair shining in the torchlight, Alan looked every inch a king. And, for once, he was talking to Simon as an equal.
"I'll think about it," Simon said.
Alan nodded.
"We're planning the attack tomorrow. The Grandmasters will try and stop me from inviting you, but I'm afraid they might try something more. Do you have the filiar I lent you?"
Simon gave Alan a blank stare.
"The little acorn thing."
"Oh, right." Simon rummaged around in one pocket and pulled out the acorn in its tiny gold cage. Alan pointed to the top, at a knob on top of the birdcage.
"If something happens to you, especially if the Grandmasters do something, turn that top part to the right. Wherever I am, it will let me know that you need help, and I'll come as soon as I can."
If Simon found himself in danger so severe that even he couldn't fight his way free, he wasn't likely to have enough time to pull out the cage, call Alan, and wait until Alan got there. But he appreciated the thought.
"Thank you, Alan."
He flashed Simon a smile.
"Don't mention it. You saved my life once, and I look forward to repaying the favor."
Then he hurried off down the hallway, catching up with the Avernus traveler who had slowed her pace to wait for him. As Simon entered his room, he shook his head. Alan was getting too used to life here in Enosh, where every random passerby treated him like royalty. The next time he tried to leave, his head wouldn't fit through the gate. Simon crossed the floor, noting with irritation how long it took him. Who needed this much space in a bedroom anyway? Not him. He summoned Azura, he had plenty of room for the sword 7 foot length, and began the process of cutting open a Valenhall gate. He'd had enough of Enosh for the moment. Maybe he could spend the next few days relaxing inside the house, where everything was only trying to kill him. When most of the other Grandmasters had finally wandered out of the council room, Grandmaster Naraka ordered the doors shut. The two servants bowed and slipped out of the room, pulling the door shut behind them. That left Naraka alone with the room's only other occupant, Grandmaster Endros. He was young, dark, and strong, consumed by the typical Endros obsession with combat strength. For a few moments during the meeting, Naraka had wondered whether she would have to summon restraints to keep him off the Valenhall boy. Not that she would have minded seeing Grandmaster Endros send Simon back to the Latari Forest in 1,000 smoking chunks, but there should be no fighting in the Grandmaster's council chambers. The law forbade it.
"What did you want with me, Endros?" Naraka asked.
Grandmaster Endros stared at her for a moment, his left hand resting on one of his swords. Naraka adjusted her red spectacles to cover the motion of her right hand, which had been marked in her territory decades ago. If Endros acted too aggressive, she could put him in his place with one more wave of her hand. She did not expect an attack from Grandmaster Endros. She had defeated his predecessor years ago, and he knew it. But it was best to be cautious. Practically every Endros she'd ever met was dangerously unpredictable. Finally, Endros took his hand from his sword and gave her a shadow of a smile.
"Nothing threatening, Grandmaster Naraka. I only wished to discuss Simon, son of Kalmon. With the Valenhall incarnation loose, he can't be trusted."
"Eliadel trusts him," Naraka pointed out. "More importantly, his mother was killed by a Damascan traveler. From what I've heard, he's full of rage. It seems he has killed more Damascan travelers than any one of us."
She had intended that as a barb, and Endros did not disappoint her.
"Not any of us," Endros said forcefully, running his hand along the hilt of his sword. "Besides, he must have been trained by the Dragon Army.
perhaps even by Indiriel himself. One of Indras's fists clenched, and Naraka suppressed a smile. He had always wanted to challenge Indiriel, even though Naraka was certain the Overlord would carve Grandmaster Endros like a ham.
"I remember a time when the Dragon Army was our strongest ally," Naraka said.
"But that was a long time ago," Endros responded.
"So it was,
before they had killed her granddaughter."
"And as for Simon,"
Endros shook his head,
"I'm not certain he's as set against Damasca as he pretends to be. He spoke with Malachi before Alan arrived, and supposedly fought with him. But if that's true, why were they both still alive when Eliadel arrived?"
"Not everyone duels to the death, Endros," Naraka said. Privately, though, she had considered the same thoughts. Grandmaster Endros took an angry step forward, looming over Naraka in what he no doubt imagined was a threatening manner.
"You take this too lightly, Naraka," he said.
Naraka sighed and waved him away.
"Settle down, child. I happen to agree with you."
Endros's face barely changed, but he blinked expressively.
"You do?" "Simon is not bound to us," she said.
"Not as tightly as Alan was, at any rate."
"He is not committed to our cause, and he has dangerously high influence over our Eliadel. We need him either securely on our side, or safely dead."
She wasn't sure which of those options she preferred. Naraka would relish the thought of the Dragon Army getting what it deserved, but she wasn't convinced Simon himself had earned a death sentence. Well, he would have to prove it. Indras's dark face almost lit up.
"In that case, I would like to be the one to duel him."
"That won't be necessary," Naraka said.
"Please, I would be happy to test myself."
"I said that won't be necessary, boy,"
Naraka snapped. She glared at him through the red-tinted glasses. When he finally nodded, she snorted and looked away.
"Besides," she said, "it's already taken care of."
Simon drew Azura down the air, the gate to Valenhall sliding into existence behind it. Whispers slid out from the gate, tickling his mind with recognition. Apparently, the dolls had something to complain about.
"I'm coming in now," Simon called. "Just wait, I'll be there in a minute."
If anything, the whispering took on an angry tone. Simon kept cutting the gate, but as the gate grew larger and more defined, the whispers became clearer. He felt that he could almost understand what they had to say. He could even recognize Otoku's voice, shouting at him among the crowd.
"They're fighting again," Simon thought.
It had happened before. Among the dozens of dolls, it was probably inevitable that they would disagree every once in a while. This time sounded worse than usual. Finally, Azura's tip reached the floor, and the Valenhall gate bloomed into a wide portrait of the house's entry hall. Simon had barely a second to take in the red cushioned furniture, the lights, the mirrors, and the sword racks on the walls before the urgent whispers crashed into his mind.
"Kill you. Run! Behind you. Outside the window, you half-wit. Hurry and dodge. Hide. Come inside, Simon. Hurry. That's what you get for leaving us behind. Hello, Simon. How are you? Flee!"
It seemed that all his dolls were speaking at once, each giving him advice that overwhelmed and conflicted with the advice of the others. He stood a moment, stunned, before the obvious message hit him. He was under attack. He spun, putting his back to the Valenhall gate, and surveyed the room. Night had fallen during the meeting with the Grandmasters, and now the room was lit by nothing more than a pair of ordinary lamps. They burned low, keeping most of the room in shadows, but he had just enough light to see. The bed, tucked into a nook in the corner, seemed undisturbed. The furniture was all in its proper place, and the curtains around the window fluttered in a gentle breeze. He could see most of the room, and he saw nothing suspicious. Otoku's voice floated to him through the gate.
"If you're done having a look around," she said, "would you come inside? Of course, if you prefer being disemboweled."
A few of her sisters chuckled appreciatively. "Where are they?" Simon sent. He held Azura in both hands, angling it across his body. The point almost scraped the ceiling.
"You should listen to us," Kayla said. "Come inside."
"Where?" Simon insisted. Several dolls sighed. Angeline spoke, as straightforward and businesslike as always.
"They're climbing up the wall, Simon. They will be inside the window in seconds."
"How many?" Simon asked.
"Three."
"Which is two more than it would take to kill you," Otoku pointed out. Simon's hands tightened on his sword. If the dolls were so worried, he should be too. They knew what he could handle, and they only wanted him to be safe. The smart thing to do would be to step through the gate. On the other hand, he was ready for something to happen. He was sick of failing to conquer the garden room, sick of the grandmasters, sick of the problems he couldn't solve. A fight would make things simple. Besides, the gate was still open. He had an easy way out.
"Once, I had a dream that we were bound to someone who actually took our advice," Lilia said. "Alas, it was only a dream."
Barely a second later, a figure in fluttering dark red clothes leaped in through Simon's open window. In an instant, Simon took in its alien appearance. It looked like a blend of lizard and man, with pebbled rust-red skin and a long lizard's tail that stretched out behind it. When it saw Simon, it hissed and flicked its tongue out like a snake, tasting the air. Its fingers were tipped by long claws, which gleamed in the dim lamplight. The lizard man wore ornate, multi-layered red clothes, stitched with symbols that Simon didn't recognize. It didn't attack at once. Instead, it stepped aside and let a second figure sneak in through the window. This one wore clothes similar to the first, only they were burnt orange instead of red. The third figure wore black. His robes looked like Simon's cloak, only with no hood and intricate silver script down the fringes. Simon called steel and essence, letting the cold strength infuse his body. Part of him wanted to charge the creatures, but for safety he should stick with the gate at his back and let them come to him.
"Why not attack?" Angeline asked.
"Strategy," Simon sent. Otoku and Kayla snickered. "Besides," he said, "maybe they're not hostile." All of the dolls started laughing.
"It's possible."
The red-dressed lizard's lips peeled back, revealing dozens of sharp triangular teeth in the flat mouth.
"We have come for your blood, traveler," it said.
"Yeah, he's probably friendly," Otoku said.
"Who sent you?" Simon demanded. He edged backward a little, toward the gate. The nigh essence slowed the world enough that Simon had to focus to understand the creature's words, but he had grown better at that over recent weeks. Now he could have a normal conversation with the nigh essence in his lungs, though he still had to focus.
"We are the Garrosh," the orange lizard man said. "In Naraka, we execute murderers. Only a month passed. You slaughtered three travelers of our territory. One of those travelers was known to us,"
the Garrosh in black put in. That one smiled, showing bloodstained teeth.
"We have come to deliver punishment."
Assassins from Naraka had come to punish him for killing travelers. Had they been summoned by Damascan travelers or crawled up from Naraka on their own? And why now? Were they afraid that he would join with Enosh?
"Eyes up front, Simon," Kayla sent.
The red Garrosh rushed forward, moving almost as fast as Simon, filled with nigh essence. By the time Simon reacted, the creature's face was a foot away from Simon's chest, its claws spread and needle sharp. The Garrosh moved as fast as Simon, but the nigh essence granted more gifts than mere speed. Simon's reactions were more coordinated and graceful under the effects of the essence, and he nimbly dodged to one side, sweeping Azura down at the reptilian assassin. The blade gleamed in the dim light as it rushed down at the lizard man's neck, blurring into a sheet of shining silver light. Upon missing Simon, the assassin in red had stumbled almost into the Valenhall gate, but had managed to catch itself in time. Not that it mattered, since Simon was about to take the lizard's head from its shoulders.
"You should look behind you," Lilia suggested.
Burning lines scraped across Simon's ribs, and he screamed at the pain, twisting to see what had happened. The Garrosh in orange had snuck up behind him, reaching under Simon's cloak and raking its claws along Simon's side. Simon had turned away so quickly that his strike missed the lizard in red entirely. Azura slammed to the floor and shattered the tiles.
"Jump to the right," Angeline said.
With all the strength of steel, Simon leaped to his right, black cloak trailing along behind him. He landed all the way across the room, landing at the foot of his bed. He brought Azura up, preparing to attack, but the black-robed Garrosh was right in front of him, its yellow snake eyes inches from his. It was close, too close to swing Azura. Tendrils of panic crept up in Simon.
"Punch it in the face," one of the dolls called.
So Simon punched the lizard man in the face with his offhand. The assassin fell back, and Simon finally had enough room to use Azura. He stepped forward in a simple thrust, but the other two Garrosh had already recovered and were scrambling toward him. If he impaled the black Garrosh, the other two would shred him to pieces with their claws. So he changed tactics. He spun in place, turning his thrust into a sweeping strike that kept the red and orange-dressed assassins at bay. He ended his spin by slamming his foot into black robes. The assassin flew backwards like a stone from a sling, flying into another window, one the lizards hadn't opened. It crashed through the glass, trailing tinkling shards, and fell through the night.
"One down," Simon sent. "Lucky you," Otoku responded. "Now turn around."
Simon spun to see both Garrosh closing in on him together. That was when the fight turned sour. The room was big enough for Simon to swing Azura, but not freely. If his swings went too wide, his blade would get caught in the walls or ceiling long enough to get him killed. He had to be conscious of the room's shape while fighting, so he moved slower than normal. More than that, the two lizard men knew how to fight in unison. When he struck at the Garrosh in red, that assassin would grab the blade in its shining claws, trying to keep him locked down, while the killer in red brought his claws in close. Simon took a cut to his left arm, blocking that maneuver, and another attempted dodge cost him a slash across the cheek. None of the damage was bad, at least nothing the healing pool of Valenhall couldn't handle, but the lizards had managed to drag the fight on. His steel would last for a while longer, but his nigh essence was running out. In seconds, Simon would be only as fast as an ordinary human. The assassins would tear him to ribbons.
"What do I do?" Simon called. "Tell me what to do."
Several of the dolls sighed.
"Get to the gate," Lilia said. "If you can."
Simon swept Azura at the orange lizard man's neck. He bent backwards. It bent almost in half, in a stomach-churning display of flexibility. But Simon managed to slip by the assassin and run toward the gate.
"Come on," Simon thought, "a little more." "Behind you," Angeline said flatly.
Simon spun around and brought Azura at the orange lizard man's neck. He bent backwards. It bent almost in half, in a stomach-churning display of flexibility. But Simon managed to slip by the assassin and run toward the gate.
"Come on," Simon thought, "a little more." "Behind you," Angeline said flatly.
Simon spun around and brought Azura up, but the red Garrosh swept the blade aside with its claws. Then it kicked Azura out of Simon's hand. The pain was intense, as though it had shattered one of the bones in Simon's wrist. Azura twisted and spun in the air, seemingly slowed because of the nigh essence in Simon's system. The Garrosh in red loomed over Simon just as the nigh essence ran out. Simon hoped it would say something, maybe to mock him, anything to give him a little time to crawl backwards into the gate, but it raised its claw before sweeping it down into Simon's neck. Without the nigh essence in him, Simon wouldn't even be able to see the blow that killed him. Still, he squirmed backward, trying to get into Valenhall. Maybe the Naraka creature wouldn't follow him into a dangerous foreign territory.
"Behind you," Kayla sent. She sounded very pleased about something.
"Behind me," Simon thought. "The gate?"
A chain-wrapped arm reached out from the gate and caught the descending claw. "They spoke to me," Kai said. He sounded on the verge of tears. "My lovely little ones. It has been far too long."
Simon all but collapsed backwards, looking up at Kai. Simon's master looked down at him, his white hair hanging down and concealing his eyes. Kai smiled.
They spoke to me again, he told Simon.
I'm happy for you, sir, Simon said. He wasn't sure what else to say. Dinner had told him that Kai didn't have the Nye essence, so Simon didn't see any way for his master to win against the two remaining Garrosh. And yet, the sight of Kai reassured him. Kai would handle it. The assassin in red was still scrabbling at Kai's hand, trying to break his grip. He slashed at Kai's wrist with his other claw, but for some reason he couldn't penetrate Kai's skin. That was probably one of the Valenhall powers that Simon didn't have yet.
"Where's Azura?" Kai asked.
Simon tried to get to his feet, but a stabbing pain in his calf told him that one of the lizard men had cut him in the leg. He didn't remember that. Simon stayed on the floor, gesturing over to the side where Azura lay on the tiles. Kai released the scaled wrist, letting the creature stumble backward. He walked over and snatched Azura up from the floor, running the palm of his hand up the back of the blade.
"Azura," Kai sighed. "How I have missed you, my dear."
The Garrosh in orange ran across the room toward Simon, both of its clawed hands extended. Simon lurched backwards, pushing himself through the gate and onto the wooden floor of Valenhall.
"Look out, Kai," one of the dolls said.
Simon didn't recognize her voice, but she sounded exasperated. From the other side of the gate, Simon watched as Azura's gleaming blade reached toward the orange Garrosh. The assassin twisted to block the strike with its claws, but Kai swung with enough force to toss the lizard to one side. The gate had stayed the same size while Simon held Azura, but now that the dragon's fang was in Kai's hand, the portal began to shrink. It seemed that only a full traveler could hold a Valenhall gate open, and only with his assigned dragon's fang. There were so many rules that Simon still didn't know, but he was starting to figure a few out. Kai strode into view, standing in the dead center of the room. He held Azura in one hand, angled carefully for attack.
"Pay close attention, little mouse,"
Kai called to Simon, in his typical sing-song voice. Simon watched through the gate as one Garrosh came at Kai in a blur of red, and the other came from the other side in a blur of orange. In response, Kai proved exactly how much Simon still had to learn. Kai met the red lizard's attack with Azura's edge, still managing to sweep one leg to the side and trip the orange-robed Garrosh. He spun Azura back at the red-robed lizard, driving him back, keeping him on the defensive, twisting back every once in a while to nick the orange one with Azura's edge. Simon could barely understand what he was seeing. Though both of the Garrosh were far faster than Kai, the white-haired swordsman seemed to know exactly where they were going to be and what they would try to do. When they attacked, he dodged, or else met them with Azura's point. He seemed to attack one or the other assassin constantly, never allowing both lizard men a chance to go on the offensive together. With only occasional input from the dolls, Kai remained untouched.
"I have a long way to go," Simon thought.
"Don't let it bother you, Simon," Kayla said. "You have time. Besides, at least you're not a creepy hermit."
"I heard that," Kai sang out. Azura took a slice out of red, pebbled skin.
"You are a murderer yourself," the red-robed Garrosh snarled, "and you stand in the way of justice."
"An excellent argument," Kai said. "Here's my counterpoint."
He spun around and stabbed the orange Garrosh in the throat. Strangely thick, dark blood gurgled as it flowed from the pierced neck. The red-robed Garrosh roared, its yellow snake eyes gleaming, and threw itself at Kai. Calmly, Kai stepped to one side and swept Azura up from the floor to the ceiling. The assassin fell to the tiles in two pieces.
"Predators from Naraka," Kai said thoughtfully. "I haven't seen those in a while. Ah, the beautiful memories of childhood."
Kai started to walk to the Valenhall gate, which had shrunk until he would have to duck to walk through it.
"Not yet," Lilia said dreamily.
Kai sighed and turned around. Through the gate, Simon couldn't see much of the room, but he could tell when the black-robed Garrosh, which had survived a four-story fall, slipped through the window and threw itself at Kai, snarling. Kai clubbed it on the skull with Azura's hilt, and it crumpled like a rag doll.
"Put up your toys when playtime is done," Kai sang out.
What? Simon thought.
Don't ask us, Otoku sent. We don't know either.
Kai reversed Azura, holding it point down, and thrust the blade down. The black-robed Garrosh twitched once and was still.
That was amazing, sir, Simon said. Thank you.
Kai waved that away.
No time for that, he said. We have real work to do. What have I told you about the incarnations?
He ducked and slipped through the gate, letting it continue to shrink behind him. Simon finally managed to stand on his one good leg. Practically nothing. Kai cocked his head for a moment before he nodded.
Yes, that sounds like me. Have you learned anything on your own?
In truth, he had tried, but no one seemed to be willing to talk about them. At least, not to him.
I haven't learned much, Simon admitted.
The Grandmasters were talking about them.
I should hope they were, Kai interrupted. One of the incarnations has escaped, and we need to put it down.
Which territory is it from? Simon asked. Kai gave him a surprised look.
Why do you think we have to deal with it? It's from Valinhal. The Valinhal incarnation has escaped, and it's on a rampage.
Internally, Simon sighed. I should have known better, he thought. I'm not going to be able to stay neutral, am I? Otoku laughed.
The reward for work well done is more work. I hope you weren't expecting a holiday.
Chapter 8 Ice and Moonlight. Leah knelt on the dusty rock, peering down over the edge of her cliff. 9 moons hung in the sky overhead, some sliding by with unnatural speed, others oddly slow. One moon in particular glowed blue and silver white, taking up a good quarter of the sky. She had made mistakes before, but tonight Leah had read Lyriel's moons correctly. They had led her to this place. Or, more accurately, they had led her to a place 100 paces away and 20 down, at the foot of the cliff on which she crouched, to the spot where 2 Lyriel travelers from Enosh stood guard. The 2 Lyriel travelers had their faces wrapped in silver ribbons, presumably to imitate their mysterious grandmaster. Leah had never seen other Lyriel travelers dressed that way, though, to be honest, she had barely seen other travelers of Lyriel at all before she came to Enosh. Unlike Grandmaster Lyriel, these travelers wore ordinary clothes of gray and black underneath their carefully wrapped shrouds. 3 glistening crystals floated in midair behind the shoulders of each traveler. Roughly the size of a clenched fist, they looked like pyramids made of mirrored glass, and they traced lazy circles as they hovered behind the travelers' heads. Leah had never seen the floating crystal pyramids before, but she had heard stories. She had heard them called star nets, artifacts left by the long-departed Deniri. Raiding Deniri tombs was always a deadly risk, though one that almost every Lyriel traveler took. Even though the crypts were sure to be unoccupied, they contained a lethal variety of tricks and traps. Even the architecture itself tended to shift, making maps useless. She repressed a shudder, remembering her single trip into a Deniri tomb. She and her mother had barely escaped with their lives, though they had chosen one of the smaller and less defended tombs. They had emerged with a handful of random devices, including her scrying lens. The fact that Enosh travelers had found 2 of the same artifact, and star nets no less, gave Leah cause to worry. Either one of the travelers below could likely take her apart. They hadn't yet noticed her trick. 7 stones, she hoped it stayed that way. The 2 Lyriel travelers stood about 10 feet apart, backs to one another, each facing a different direction. Every few minutes, they would walk a few paces to one side or another to keep a different angle in view. They never crossed the invisible 10-foot circle between them. Tonight, the spot they guarded led directly into the Enosh Grandmaster's council room. There was nothing to mark the place, and for good reason. The appropriate location for Lyriel gates shifted with the moons. In hours, perhaps minutes, this spot could lead to a random outhouse in Belkalem instead, or to the middle of the Bedari Desert. Grandmaster Lyriel had calculated the correct spot for their meeting and sent guards hours ago. Leah had gotten there first. In the center of that circle, buried in the sandy gray dirt that covered practically every inch of Lyriel, was a very special crystal.
Leah had constructed it herself, out of the same stone that made her bracelet. From the time it was activated until it ran out of energy, the crystal would peer through a tiny gate, observing and recording whatever happened in the real world. The material for the crystal was rare, it took days to create, and it could only be used once. But anything that allowed her to spy on Enosh without exposing herself to danger was worth almost any price. She suspected that the Grandmaster's meeting should be ending soon. She had waited here more than 2 hours, and time in Lyriel moved the same as time in the real world. Usually. Now all she had to do was wait for the guards to open a gate and leave, and she could go back down and retrieve her recording crystal. Easy. She would be back in Enosh within the hour. Hopefully she wouldn't have to materialize in a broom closet this time, and if anyone questioned how long she'd been gone, she could claim she'd gotten lost. Content with her plan, Leah almost didn't notice a particular detail. The wind was blowing. Weather of any kind was rare in Lyriel. The sky was clear 9 nights out of 10, and most rainstorms brief. When the sky was covered and the moon's hidden, traveling accurately became a nightmare. There were no clouds tonight, as usual, just a slow and steady wind. At first, she noticed the grit blown in the wind as something she had to keep out of her eyes while she watched the two guards below. The silver ribbons on the Enosh travelers' masks began to trail off to one side. Dust drifted over their boots. Leah watched the process for several minutes before it occurred to her that the wind could spell disaster. She had not buried her crystal deeply. Only a few inches of dust covered the rocks down there, and her crystal was the size of a small plum. If the wind kept up, the crystal would be exposed in minutes. The Grandmasters would know for sure they had an enemy in Lyriel. She could wait no longer. She couldn't let the Enosh travelers find the crystal, and she couldn't fight them both, not armed as they were. Lyriel was not a combat-oriented territory. Legend held that Lyriel travelers had once been scouts and watchful sentinels, protecting and spying for the Elysian travelers of old. Certainly, the Lyriel powers she knew focused on the gathering and preserving of information, not anything destructive. Star nets, supposedly, were something else. They were rare, expensive and difficult to make even for the ancient Daenerys race, and used only as a last resort. That meant that either of those travelers would be more than a match for her in an open battle. She could use her crown. With that, she could perhaps kill or capture both enemies before it came to a battle, which meant 2 star nets for her collection, which would most likely put her in contention with Grandmaster Lyriel and Overlord Belanine for the title of most powerful Lyriel traveler in the world. But no, it was too risky. She had to be close to use the crown, and she would have to phrase her command perfectly. Plus, as an artifact of Ragnaros, it was difficult to summon here, and it might prove to be unexpectedly weak. Weapons of one territory often weakened or failed entirely when taken to a foreign territory. In the worst-case scenario, one of the travelers down below would sense her summoning the crown and attack before she had a chance to get close enough. Leah leaned back over the cliff and couldn't stop a gasp. Shifting moonlight gleamed off a crystal in the dust, directly between both Enosh travelers. If either one turned around, they couldn't fail to notice. She had to solve the problem now, and she had to rely on her Lyriel powers, which, unfortunately, meant that she had to deplete her source even further. Reluctantly, Leah reached out her mind to her sanctum and pulled. Hundreds of miles away, hidden in a crack between cliffs, Leah's sanctum sat tucked away. It was protected by a hand